Daniel Katz is a renowned art dealer, collector, and gallery owner who has very much beaten his own path through the tangled forests of the art world. Although he left school at the age of 14, his energetic curiosity brought him early success, making a profit of £15 on the first bronze he bought and discovering something quite unexpected inside a grandfather clock. Dan is an expert on European sculpture, but has also branched out into new fields, including antiquities, old masters, impressionist paintings, and modern British art. He's worked closely with museums, exhibitions, and libraries around the world. You've brought us musical treasures today, Danny. Debussy, Schubert, Sibelius. But I think you want to begin with a track from West Side Story.
Yes, we immigrated to America when I was very young and spent years there. When we came back, I had watched the films of Gene Kelly and A Smattering of Fred Astaire. And in 1960 or 61, West Side Story came out. And I took myself along to see this film and I was completely transfixed by it and thought, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I wanted to be a dancer. I thought at that point, that's what I wanted to do, was to be a professional dancer. Fate took me another direction, but I was quite amazed by the opening scene with Bernstein's music. It invoked a time in America with gang warfare, and today it's very contemporary. I mean, the story, it's a new taking of Romeo and Juliet, but I think it's what's happening in cities and all over the world today. Those tensions still occur and happen, and I think that music picks up very well. Thank you.
the prologue to Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, performed by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. It's an extraordinary kind of American gift to be able to write music that is streetwise, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Listening to that piece of music, I could hardly sit in the seat recording. I wanted to dance. It just is the most evocative piece of music. But as you quite rightly say, it is so powerful and it is just made to move. The dynamics in it and the vibrancy of it is just... Ooh.
Danny Kurtz, how was it that your parents decided to up sticks and, quite a young age in your case, take you to the US?
Well, my father was in the RAF during the war, and when the war ended, they were loose and they didn't have any money like most people. And my father had an office in a burnt-out, bombed-out building in the city of London, and my brother and I as kids used to go there. And he was selling one of the first adding-up machines called Exactus. This would be about 1953. And then in 55, we saved up enough money to go for a new life. It was hopeless in Britain. There was nothing going on. In California, my brother, my mother and I went on the Queen Mary across to New York, spent a couple of days in New York. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, it was extraordinary. Then flew on to California, where my father had gone on a month earlier and got accommodation, a small flat. And she worked sewing up movie stars' dresses. My father worked in a haberdashery store selling clothes, and I took to it like a fish to water. I absolutely loved it and met all sorts of people like Jack Benny. I met Sammy Davis Jr. I was photographed with Elvis Presley when I was a kid. I met everyone, and I had the time of my life.
How did you come to meet Elvis?
I was at a school called Horace Mann, who was an educator in America, and all the kids were used as extras in the film sets. And one day we were all invited to the film lot where they were making Jailhouse Rock, and we were invited to meet Elvis. And I was taken there and had a photograph taken and shook his hand, and there you are. I tell that story many times. I get a lot of good street cred for a few years doing that.
Tell me about your next piece, Danny.
Whilst living in California, I was at a friend's house, and there was a violinist comedian called Jack Benny, who was very popular in the 1950s. And he put on the radio, and I heard a piece of music called Clair de Lune by Debussy, played by Arthur Fiedler and the Boston Pops Orchestra, which was very, very popular in America at the time. And that piece of music resonated with me for the rest of my life. But the piece I've chosen is another work by Debussy called L'Après-midi de Fond. That piece of music, when I part this world, that's the piece of music I like to have played. Having been interested in the ancient world, the classical world, for many, many years, when I first saw it performed, I saw this frieze of muses or nymphs lined up with this classical 5th century Greek archaic style. And I was completely shocked what I saw. It was like the ancient world coming to life in this sort of golden age of classicism. And then the faun comes on and does this incredible dance. And when I learnt to dance, I always wanted to take that role, but of course I wasn't good enough. It is a piece of music that I play at least once a week, and if ever I get a bit hyper, which I tend to do, it calms me down. It has a very meditative and contemplative quality.
part of the Prelude à l'Opéra Midi d'un Fou by Claude Debussy, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by Claudio Abbado. Did that relax you, Danny?
Oh, actually in this studio perhaps not, but still wonderful to hear.
What prompted your family to return to the UK in 1961?
My grandmother had passed away and they wanted to go back to England. My parents were homesick. They didn't make it in California. They tried hard. I didn't want to go. I hated it. The thought of going back to England. I hated school. I only lasted a year in English school. Couldn't stand it. Short trousers and playing football on a snowy day when I'd been surfing on the beach in Malibu the day before. And I couldn't stand it. And I had a strong American accent. And the school said, well, we'll kick that out of you. That's the first thing we'll do.
And you went to work in a bowling alley, didn't you?
Yes, became rather good at it, and 14 became British champion at Tenpin Bowling, which was quite good. I went up to Wembley with one friend, and the chap who was my opponent had 150 friends, and I beat him solidly and came down to Brighton and got a bit of prize money, and that set me on my way.
Your parents ran a petrol station, and I think you helped them out.
Yes, I was working as a petrol pump attendant from 6:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night, with a half an hour break. I was a very hard-working young man. And unfortunately, they went bust. And it was in all the public newspapers in Brighton. It was a bit of public humiliation, but we all got over that. And they managed to save a couple of £1,000 and open an antique shop in the lanes in Brighton. And I just loved every minute of it.
Was it the trauma of that bankruptcy, do you think, that possibly contributed in any way to your getting Tourette's?
I personally think it was the shock of leaving America. I was desperately unhappy when I came back to England, on the beach one day and snow the next day, and I hadn't seen snow, I think, since I was 4 years of age. I think it was that that brought it on, and it waxes and wanes.
What symptoms do you tend to have?
For me, body twitching, shaking the head, which gives you sort of like a mild concussion. So, of course, my wife thinks I've got Alzheimer's, but I haven't, because I get a bit of forgetfulness when that happens. General extreme uncomfortableness. And, you know, I don't have any embarrassment. I don't sort of have the embarrassment gene, so I can go and do anything and make a fool of myself. But I talk to children regularly and help people with this condition. I know a lot about it and founded the Tourette Association with Jeremy Stern, who's a leading neurologist 30 years ago. It's not a light-hearted. People have made fun and jokes about it, but anyone having it is no fun. There's nothing positive about it. Some people have said to me, because I've been rather successful in my career, oh, I wish I'd have a bit of Tourette's, you know, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. It's very unpleasant.
Has it affected your work? Has it held you back in any way?
No, I'm a bundle of energy. I mean, I've just got a very full character. I don't really get very low. I get very high. Wake up every morning kind of positive. Think what the day is going to bring.
Well, we haven't entirely left the USA, musically speaking, because the next piece really sums up your love of California.
Yes, I have been back many times since, and it is not the same as when I was there as a kid. But California Dreaming, I think, was really performed by the Mamas and the Papas. I was in Beverly Hills, and we call them haciendas, the little houses there, and they're all built in this colonial way of Spain. And you mustn't forget that it is Los Angeles. It's a Spanish town. The Spanish influence there was very strong. It really was very much neo-Spanish. And I thought the version by Jose Feliciano, particularly the bit when he sings in Spanish, would sum up my time in America.
All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be safe and warm if I was any late. Thank you. out the long way. Well, I got down on my bended knees, and I began to pray. You know the preacher digs a call. He knows I'm gonna stay. Yes, he knows, 'cause I told him so. Such a winter's day, yeah. Well, baby, oh, the leaves are brown. The sky is gray. Oh, I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be safe and warm if I was bitter, if I was in LA. Porque yo me siento tan bien, y por eso yo te quiero, porque tú me tratas bien. En California, mira, no seas tan mala, nena, no me trates así, que yo me quiero morir, muchachita, por tu amor, nada más. Oye, no me digas que no, porque yo... Oye, mulata, mira, baby, hey, California dreaming. It doesn't matter how you say it. All I wanna say is I love California, baby, yeah. I really need a little loving, yeah.
California Dreaming, written by Tom and Michelle Phillips, performed by Jose Feliciano. I think you were right, that did give it an extra kind of bite, didn't it?
This I think so.
Your parents opened up an antique shop in the Lanes in Brighton.
Yeah.
And so you began working for them there. Can you remember your first sale?
Yes. I bought a bronze, a copy of the 16th century Italian sculptor Gian Bologna, bought it for £5 and sold it for £20 to a London dealer. It was a copy, at least I assume it was a copy. Maybe it was the real thing, who knows?
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it, that you could make £15 in one day. That was pretty good going. So it continued and continued. One day I had a chap come into the shop, an Eastern European emigre, and invited me to his home to meet his wife and have tea, because he liked the way I handled bronzes. And I went to his flat and walked in, and I'd never seen anything like it. It was Aladdin's cave. There was Renaissance bronzes, watercolours by Egon Schiele, drawings by Gustav Klimt, Persian carpets, Chinese jades, small Degas pastels of ballet dancers, a Rodin bronze of the thinker. It was the most extraordinary. And there was this music being played, and I didn't know what it was. I said to the guy, what is this sound? He said, that's Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, and you ought to listen to this, because do you know about Bach? I didn't know anything about Bach. So I sat down for 1.5 hours. I was completely transfixed to this music. And that meeting with that gentleman 60 years ago changed my life.
He was Michael Travers,
yes,
wasn't he? Hungarian-born collector, but also an ophthalmologist and an expert.
Yes. He introduced me to Sir John Pope Hennessy at the time, who was the director of the Victoria and Albert Museum, and quite a frightening, distinguished man, who had no interest in me, but introduced me to a young man who come from the film world, and he was an expert in Renaissance bronzes, and took me under his wing. And I used to bring up things every week in the back of my car and show him, and one day I hit the jackpot. Something turned up rather wonderful.
It's not Bach we're going to hear now, but Beethoven.
Well, I chose the Beethoven because when I moved to London in 1970, I had a small little flat off the King's Road, which I paid £10 a week for. And I was extremely lonely with very little money, running a relative of mine's art gallery in Mount Street in Mayfair, selling antiquities, ancient Roman and Greek, which I knew nothing about, but I learnt pretty quickly. And I heard on the radio some Beethoven sonatas, and I'd bought myself a record player, and fruit was often packed in the 60s and 70s in boxes, cheap wood. And I remember getting an orange box from the fruit market, taking the fruit out and just putting it on its side and playing it as if it was a piano, which I can't play the piano. I have no talent. Oh, the best bit when you cross your hands. I fall off the piano. And I played it every day. And I remember the Appassionata and the Moonlight and the Pathetique. And I think for that year, Beethoven really was my spiritual father. He saved my life. So I couldn't wait to get home in the evening and just took a takeaway meal and played Beethoven on the orange box. And it was wonderful. And I didn't know what one to choose, but the last movement of the Moonlight just fills me full of hope.
There's a kind of restless energy there, and it rather made me think of a young man with aspirations wanting to get on with things, possibly to learn the piano, but also to get on with life. Is that why it spoke to you, perhaps?
I think that's a very good observation. The fact is that I'm now 77, and I have more energy now than I think I had then. So the idea of retiring or settling down and mowing the lawn or playing golf is an abhorrence to me. I just have so many things I want to do.
We heard the Presto Agitato, the third movement from Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy. You mentioned Pope Hennessy was a famous figure, of course, and him introducing you to, I imagine, it was Anthony Radcliffe.
Yes, correct.
And I think you developed quite a sort of symbiotic relationship, and you were allowed to wander around the V&A.
I was given carte blanche to the room 64 at that time upstairs in the Renaissance galleries, where they had about 350 Renaissance bronzes and Baroque bronzes on show. They've since been taken down, and I was allowed to go in there once a week and with the key and literally take out anything I wanted to and study them. You learn much more handling these things than you do about reading books about the subjects. There's nothing like handling the things and seeing the patina and the test of time and turning the sculptures around and seeing the omnidirectional viewpoints, how many viewpoints you can find. and the tension and the dynamics of how these things work and how these things were important to people in the humanist period where Christianity and the classical world juxtaposed very well together. It was a new way of thinking. It was a completely exciting period from, say, 1440 onwards until the Enlightenment came in the 18th century. But yes, the V&A really was my university.
Early on in your career, Danny, you spotted a bronze in a shop window.
Yes, I was driving through Croydon on the way to Brighton one year, it must be 1970, and saw something shiny in an antique shop. So I stopped the car, went in, and there was this bronze. And I don't know what it was, but I thought, it looks like a Gian Bologna model, part of it, and the other one was another figure. And I said, how much was it? It was at £200. And I bought it, took it back to London, couldn't figure out what it was. So I took it to the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum, and I said to the tech, look, I've got this. And he went, he was so excited. He said, look, I'm not going to tell you who made this bronze. You can find out yourself. But if you lend it to the V&A for 5 years, I will publish a book all about it. So obviously I thought it was important. So I lent it for 5 years. And it turned out to be by an artist called Ferdinando Tacca, who was the missing link between full-blown mannerism in Florence and the Baroque period in sculpture. He was the missing link. And Tony Radcliffe had identified this artist. And the subject was called Burano and Olympia. And it was taken from an epic poem called Orlando Furioso by Ariosto. And I kept the bronze 40 years until it went to an American museum. But that was a really good episode in my life of discovery.
A return on the 200 quid.
A very good return, yeah. I can't complain about that, yeah.
But you also had another lucky break, which enabled you to buy a house.
Yes, well, it's very funny. I went up to London and I went into the local auction room and I bought a ship's clock for £15. And I took it back on the train and I put it in the window of my dad's shop. And some American buyers from Texas came in because all the flights from Texas used to land at Gatwick Airport. And they came and they said, how much is the ship's clock? So I said, £45. And they argued a bit and I'd reduced the price. They said, look, we're going back to Texas this afternoon. Could you wrap it up so we can take it on the plane? So I said, okay. So I wrapped it up and I put my hand in to stop the movement. And I found in there a soft leather pouch. And I picked it up and I thought, what's this? They were 18 or 20 Netsuki ivories, these little 18th and 19th century ivories, carvings, and the Japanese used to wear around their belt for luck. And I thought, well, I better not tell him about those. So I put those aside and he took the clock and very happy. And I thought, wow, this is a bit of luck. I wonder where they came from. I was a ship's captain. It must have been a captain's ship who'd gone to Japan, bought these things, put them in the clock and forgot about them. And 200 years later, I've got them. So I put them into auction and I did so well that I bought a house with the money. And I was 18 at the time, so that was a bit of luck.
Can you describe the feeling you get when you see a work of art that sets you on fire, that makes you want to buy it, that makes you think, I must have this?
Well, I thought about ownership. My wife is totally against me owning anything, but she has a more of an egalitarian approach to life, but she's Norwegian, so they would be like that. But I don't have to own everything. I get great pleasure out of going to museums. As a matter of fact, I spend half my life in museums. If I'm lucky enough to be invited to someone's house, I never talk about myself or what I collect. I'm so involved and engrossed in what I'm shown. I can get excited by a St. Cloud paperweight or a piece of Nelsy glass. I'm just fascinated in the whole of man's creativity from ancient times to today. It's just extraordinary because I'm not a very creative person. I can't make anything or play an instrument, but I love what other people have managed to do. And I wonder the bewilderment of the whole thing. I do own quite a lot of art and I enjoy it. So occasionally I let it go. But just the experience of being round those objects, it's not, as some people would say, the art of the deal. It's not that. It's actually, there was a book written by an old director of the Metropolitan Museum called Thomas Hoving, called The Chase and the Capture. You chase the work of art. For a brief moment in time, you own it or it owns you, or you're the keeper of it. then you let it go, and then it's on to the next one. So it is a lifelong experience of chasing, capturing, and letting go.
Well, that's quite a poetic way of putting it, and it's music from The Hours by Philip Glass next, and it's called The Poet Acts, actually.
Well, I was introduced to Philip Glass many years ago with one of those films he made, and I was fascinated. Listen to this minimalist music. I'd never heard that type of music before. And I followed his career for the last 30, 40 years. And there was a film made some years ago called The Hours, and the music just haunted me. And I thought, what a perfect music to dance. So the opening movement called The Poet Acts, I sort of choreographed a dance for myself. And every time I hear it, I just think of dance.
Well, this studio's a bit small for you to
I won't
execute,
get up and dance, no.
But we will imagine you dancing okay. While we listen to
okay.
It. The Poet Acts from the film The Hours by Philip Glass, performed by the Lyric Quartet with Chris Lawrence playing the double bass, conducted by Nick Ingham. Danny Katz, the art world is a hard one to break into, and I wonder whether there was a particular sale that really sort of made it for you.
Yes, I spent a lot of time in Sweden as a young man. My girlfriend, we had a child together called Anna, who I'm very close to. And I was introduced by a museum director to a tale he told me about a country house in the middle of Sweden that had a rather good sculpture in there. Would I like to go and see it? It was the middle of the winter and I didn't have a car, so I rented a Honda Civic and actually drove 20 minutes across the ice in the middle of the winter, which was the only way to get across to this house. And I walked in, it's freezing cold, and I saw this marble Venus, which I couldn't believe my eyes. I recognised it as a lost Giambologna masterpiece. And after a year and a half of talking and negotiating and trying to lend it to the V&A for a Giambologna exhibition, I was obsessed with that sculpture at the time, I managed to acquire it and export it to England and made a sale to the J. Paul Getty Museum in California for a very healthy return, very, very healthy, which completely changed my life financially. It gave me the means to become with the big boys now. I was recognised as a major player. So I went on then to buy French Impressionist paintings, and I even bought a Modigliani nude at one point, which I wished I hadn't sold. But I published it, this piece, and it's one of the star pieces of sculpture in the J. Paul Getty Museum in California now. That was over 50 years ago.
You became, Danny Katz, an expert in 16th century bronze sculptures, but as you've suggested, you haven't limited yourself to that. So is it important and is it difficult to acquire knowledge in these different fields?
I think most people I know in life major themselves in one particular subject. The field of Renaissance bronzes, I'd seen so many, I'd asked so many questions, I'd read so many books, I'd looked so many manuscripts, I'd made comparisons, that I couldn't get any further. There was nowhere I could go. I'd seen so many. So I had to look at different areas. So then I went back to the ancient world, which is the roots of all these things, and from that drew into painting, into sculpture, into ceramics, into everything. But the curiosity of every culture, of humans' creativity through from pre-dynastic Rome to today, is bewildering, and I literally get too overexcited. I'm overstimulated in my mind, everything I see. And if I see Roman glass, I then want to build a collection of Roman glass. Over the last few years, I've been building a collection of Islamic pottery, the golden age of Islamic thought and creativity from the 9th century to the 14th century. Just one thing leads to the other. Same with music. I've never been very good at reading long academic books, whether it's about music or about any subject, because the amount of detail in there is too much to take in and you forget it. So I decided I would try and find the person who wrote the book, take them out for a good lunch, and question them for an hour and a half about the seminal parts of the book. And you take home more information which you can remember from that encounter than you will forever by reading a book.
You've helped major institutions like the British Museum and the Louvre acquire works of art. Are you like a kind of midwife in these transactions?
Oh, being fortunate to be quite successful in my work, I found it was time to give back some of the trappings of success. I remember recently the keeper of Western art at the Courtauld Institute came to me with a wonderful drawing. It was a self-portrait by Wyndham Lewis. It's a marvellous self-portrait from about 1916. And they brought the drawing to me and they said, Danny, we're trying to raise some money. Do you know anybody who might pay for this? Because we really want it. And I said, how much is it? They told me the price. I just wrote a check. And I said, well, you have to have this. And I had such an exhilarating feeling of being able to help a museum, an institution, acquire this. Since then, a lot of people asked me if I could help them, but I think the most memorable one was a Titian that I helped, the Ashmolean purchase some years ago, which I go and visit every couple of months to look at. England is such a cornucopia of wealth with our institutions and museums, and so many treasures, that everything should be done to help keep that tradition alive.
Schubert next, Danny Katz.
Well, I was in a record shop, an old-fashioned one in Portobello Road, buying some South American tango music by Astor Piazzolla, who I absolutely adore his music. And suddenly they put on this music, and it was Schubert's Death and the Maiden. And I thought, wow, this is something extraordinary. And Schubert is one of those composers that really lets himself go. I mean, he's telling love and everything. And the Death and the Maiden, I know it's a medieval story, but he brings it to life in this incredible piece of music.
of the first movement, the Allegro, from the Schubert String Quartet in D minor, Death and the Maiden, performed by the Hagen String Quartet. Danny Katz, your philanthropy extends to sponsorship of the charity Tourette's Action UK.
Yes, we recently helped Nottingham University research into Tourette's syndrome and what is actually the cause, and hopefully more treatments can be made to alleviate the symptoms that people suffer.
What do we think is the cause now, or might be?
In layman's term, it's an overstimulation of the brain. So basically, it opens the floodgates for too much stimulation, and the brain can't take it. Most people, it's an excessive amount of dopamine. That leads to involuntary tics, which can be very powerful and can be very disabilitating. I've known people to actually take their eye out with a pencil and tear a house down by that.
You've developed a wearable device to help people with Tourette's. What does it do?
You put it on your wrist, you press a button, and electric shock, very mild, goes up your arm and it goes into the basal ganglia in the back of the brain, which is where the motor part of the body works, the brain works. And it sort of counterbalances everything that's out of key. It was peer-reviewed last year and will come to the market next year. But it does work. If I'm recording in the studio now, going to give a speech, and you suffer from anxiety, you can put this gadget on your wrist and you calm down for an hour or two. So it is beneficial. And it's non-invasive, so it'll help a lot of people, particularly children, I hope.
We're going to hear a piece by your son, Robin, now, and he's a great fan of Django Reinhardt.
Oh, a fan. He was obsessed by Django. I followed him for years playing Django Reinhardt. And then a few years ago, he said to me, "You know, Dad, I cannot play Django anymore. I've played it all my life. I'm going to go into composition." And he started composing. And a few months ago, he said to me, "Dad, I've done a body of work which I'm very, very proud of." And this is a track from his album, which I find very beautiful.
Thank you.
We heard Robin Katz playing his Shadows on the guitar, with Guy Barker arranging his orchestra, from the album Oceans for Eros. There are moments in that at the beginning, Danny, where I thought this is a little bit like the Glass music you liked, in that it had a...
Well, Robin really likes minimalism. I mean, he goes to all classical concerts and all jazz concerts. He's a great music aficionado. But when he practices at home, I can't bear it. I mean, just listening to someone, my wife and I go crazy just practicing. But when it all comes together, it's wonderful. No one should go and listen to someone practicing. It's really a solo thing to do.
The focus of your gallery is on private collectors. How do you advise clients in terms of what they should buy? Do you try and suggest things that would suit their personality?
That's a very difficult question. I do make one point. I never, ever advise people to buy art as investing. I mean, 80% of all my clients are museums. But if a client comes in and is interested in seeing works of art, I will show them, I will talk about them. The least thing I want to do is talk about the financial side of it. I just say, you know, make your money or whatever in your business, but buy art as something that you appreciate and you love and you can afford, whether it's £5 or whatever the amount is. It may be the best investment you ever make in your life, but the investment you make is the appreciation and the love of owning this work of art. And I try and put my love and experience into them. It's called selling, which I'm quite good at doing.
Obviously. Yeah. Some see the art world as being a bit of a playground for the very wealthy. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I think everybody, or most people from all over the world, as a child, would collect. If you're in an island, you collect shells. If you're a kid and growing up in California, it was baseball cards. In England, it'd be football cards. We're all kids. We're all children. But the word sophistication didn't come into it when we were kids because we didn't know what that word meant. We were pure in our minds and we were full of ideas and experiences and curiosity. If you ever let the child in yourself go, then you're a very sorry place.
You're very good at doing deals. Do you drive hard bargains?
Oh, no, I'm a complete pussycat. I mean, I give in. I mean, anybody can come in with any offer I'll accept. I mean, I'm totally full of desperation all the time. No, seriously, horses for courses.
Do you have particular approaches that you find work well with clients?
Yeah, buy cheap, sell dear. Now I don't look for bargains anymore. I pay whatever it takes. And I've broken the world record for so many artists recently that I think I'm completely potty. I bid against my clients and I have nowhere to go. And I think I don't really care. I love it so much. If someone wants to buy it and I want to sell it, maybe they'll pay me a little bit more. But it's a wonderful experience. It's been a wonderful journey and I have no regrets and we'll do it all over again.
Danny Katz, in recent years, you've rather branched into 20th century art and made a number of films with Andrew Graham Dixon for the BBC about British painters like Sickert, Bomberg and Edward Burrough, but also Paul Nash, and you have a particular love for his work.
Yeah, well, the films were made about war artists during the First World War, and I think we were the only country that did such a thing. And Paul Nash particularly is the epitome of an Englishman being a romantic in his early works, a neo-romantic looking back at William Blake, and then going on to see the horrors of the First World War and painting with no actual dead bodies or instruments of war, these incredible morbid paintings of what it was like in the trenches, and I think the greatest paintings of the First World War ever created. And then part of the international movement into surrealism in the 1930s. It doesn't seem to have much of an international following, but I think he's one of the greatest painters we've ever produced in this country. He died from asthma attack just after the Second World War. Very sad, very lonely, unrequited love and tragedy, but a body of work that's unparalleled in the canon of British art.
When we visited you, there was a rather extraordinary occurrence. A taxi driver was returning something you'd left in his cab. Now, I mean, I once lost an opera, but I think you managed to up the ante on that
one. Yeah, I just purchased the most beautiful late Turner watercolour, and I was picking it up from the gallery where I'd bought it from taking it to my gallery, and I left it in the taxi. And it was quite a valuable thing, and the staff freaked out, and I was quite calm and said, it'll turn up. Well, it didn't turn up for an hour and a half, and it wasn't a pre-booked taxi, but the taxi driver happened to remember me, and he brought it back. He was handsomely rewarded, I must say, but and you just walked in when the thing arrived. So
there was relief all round. I mean, after all...
Exhilaration.
You could have bought fleets of taxis, probably, for what the tour was.
Yeah, probably.
Shostakovich next.
Well, I heard Shostakovich on Radio 3 one day and thought, wow, this is absolutely extraordinary, and then decided to find out about the life of this composer in Soviet Russia, the trials and tribulations of having to be judged by the Soviet system. It must have been awful. And I remember Robin, as a young child from age about 7 onwards, every New Year's Eve, we'd invite a few friends round to open a bottle of bubbly for New Year's Eve. And at midnight, I'd put on the Allegro from Shostakovich's 8-string quartet. And we'd lie there in the dark with just one candle and listen to this piece of music. And I know it is very sinister because it invokes the memories of the bombing of Dresden in the Second World War and the sirens and the staccato of machine gun fire. It's actually a very tragic story, but it's one of the most exhilarating, frightening pieces of music I've ever heard in my life. And to play it for a 7-year-old must have been quite a frightening experience, even though he took to it very well. And we still play this piece of music today. I actually had it performed in the gallery a few months ago by some members of the Allegri String Quartet, and the audience just couldn't deal with it. It was just so overpowering. You know the story of when it was first performed by the Borodin String Quartet. They were very keen to hear Shostakovich's reaction to their playing, and he just put his head in his hands and wept. That said it all for them. They quietly packed up their instruments and left. Thank you.
The Allegro Molto from Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8 in C minor, performed by the Borodin Quartet. Provenance, Danny Katz, must be a huge part of what you do these days.
Yes, the art world is now extremely regulated, where beforehand it was a wild west. You could move anything from any country and it didn't matter. But now people come in and the first thing they ask is the provenance before even looking at something, which I think is kind of weird. But this came about because of looted antiquities. Most antiquities of them on the market are not looted. They've been around forever. The other problem is restitution from Jewish properties that was taken during the Nazi era and people claiming these things. And you have to try and find out where these things were between 1939 and 1945. In some cases, it's impossible to find that. So the auctioneers give guarantees now that nothing's going to happen, but they have lists of things that were taken and families that these were taken. And I would not want to be party to anything that was taken and under duress in my career. So you have to be very careful.
What are the things that you've recently bought that have got you most excited?
I bought a work by a Belgian symbolist artist called Ferdinand Knopf. This is a work of the city of Bruges, about 1900 in Belgium, which is known as the Totenstadt, the dead city, where it stayed as if it was wrapped up in a cocoon from its heydays in the 15th century, when it was part of the wool trade, weaving and wool, and it was very, very rich, and they commissioned Italian artists to come there. Even Michelangelo made a sculpture for Bruges Cathedral, and then it just went quiet for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Ferdinand Knopf captures the quietness and the eeriness and the surrealness and the symbolism of that city.
Is it true that you sometimes buy back things that you've collected and sold?
Yes. The Ferdinand Knopf is one of those cases. I'd sold it 15 years earlier and bought it back from the collector who'd moved on and wanted to collect something else.
Would you sell it again?
No. Well, hopefully not. I'd like to keep it as long as possible. Mm. I'm getting on a bit, so I won't. It's interesting. I hate selling, and I hate not selling. So there's this dichotomy. I'm pulling and pushing all the time. I'm really stuck in the middle somewhere. I'm tormented soul to be damned forever.
You look pretty happy to me for a tormented soul.
Yeah.
Well, so much for your recent acquisitions. What's your final piece of music?
Scandinavia's been part of my life since I was 18, a very, very, very strong part of my life. And I've always admired the Finnish people. And Sibelius comes to my mind because he is so grounded in Finnish law and Finnish countryside that the music really resonates to his experiences as a young man and growing up in Finland. And the Fifth Symphony has these build-ups of emotions, and it just takes you over. A difficult composer at times, but the Fifth Symphony is my favourite.
Well, it only remains for me to say to you, Danny Katz, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.